website, when launched, is like a TripAdvisor. You go on, and after you've experienced a restaurant or a hotel or an attraction, you can rate your experience there. And over the course of time, we'll engage the local community to help us rate and rank all the things that we love to do here. So when a visitor goes to go see Portland, they'll really understand the experience that we as locals like to have and understand how well we think it works. It also provides us an opportunity to get feedback from those same visitors and give it to our member businesses and to other businesses so that we always make sure that we're focused on what's the customer's experience. We've also implemented this year blogs for indie music, food, and fashion on the website. So we're really trying to stay in tune with who the customer is. Hotel and transient lodging measurement. You know, as you know from the transient lodging tax, it's up 9% through this year, November. It was up 10% last year and 12% the year before. We're having great success with the hotel business. Occupancy in the greater Portland area is 71.8%, Central City 77.6%. Those are excellent numbers when you compare us to our competitive cities. You look at the average daily room rate, it's up 9% in both cases. And the most important measurement is revenue per available room, which is up 11%. We work with our hotel partners to really track this business, and I believe we've got more opportunity in room rate in Portland, and I think you'll see that continue to happen. And with the new product coming on, we really have an opportunity to grow that business. The measure of lost opportunities. We really try very carefully to look at why we lost a piece of business. And as you can see, in 2007, we booked 411 pieces of business for 251,000 room nights. That's a lot of room nights in hotels in Portland. We also lost 35 to cost rate, 68 to headquarters hotel or hotel package issues, and 8 to date availability. When you look at the 68 that we lost to hotel package, headquarters hotel, that's over $60 million in economic impact just out of those meetings. So, as we look to the future, we're very excited about the opportunity, not only with the headquarters hotel, but really continuing to go after medium-sized pieces of business that fit into Portland. One of the trends that we are seeing is that we are attracting smaller groups as opposed to the 6,000 and 7,000 room night groups because of the success in the hotels right now. We are having to put those groups into 8 or 9 hotels where our competitive cities like Seattle can put them in 2 or 3. So we are now attracting somewhat smaller groups, so the economic impact is less, but we are really focusing on what our market niche are and how can we go after that business successfully. Another one of the business cards you'll see here. We do a survey every 2 years of our membership. How are our programs? What's the value of your membership, and how are the programs of your membership? And you can see the results there. One of the new programs that we're starting this year is the Green Certification Program. We're very excited about this. We think we're the first CVB in the country to be doing this. And we have seminars with local businesses that do certification, like RecycleWorks, and we match those with our members and allow them to interact with those different certification programs to understand how they can become certified. Once they are certified, then we note that on our website, and when a visitor is coming to look for a green meeting or just a green tourism trip, they can go on and see who our certified members are to understand that they're really getting that sustainable experience that they're looking for. We really think that this has an opportunity to not only stop here, but to move on to the restaurants and to other businesses so that when we go out and sell the city, we're selling the total package. One of our charges from the city is to ensure broad regional representation, and you can see the numbers of members by county and area here. You know, the customer, when they think about Portland, they don't know where the county lines are, and they frankly don't care. When they think Portland, they think regionally, from the mountain to the coast, quite frankly. So we make sure that we engage stakeholders from across the region, across the state, and even into Washington to really understand what the Portland experience is and how do we make sure we tell that story well. So I think we've done a terrific job of including those member businesses. These are the categories of business that we represent, the top categories. And as you can see there, restaurants and accommodations at the top. But catering companies, tour companies, associations also are on the list. And the most interesting to me is 13 real estate agents are members of Travel Portland because they understand, as a visitor is coming here or as someone looking to move here, finds our website, they have a unique opportunity to capture a piece of business there. So all kinds of businesses understand the value of working with us. 18% of our members are minority or women-owned businesses, like the Empowerment Group, Queen of Sheba, Ethiopian Restaurant, plus many other ethnic restaurants, Ebony Notes, which is an entertainment organization, and El Hispanic News. Cooperative marketing strategies. This is really one of the backbones of why we've been so successful. The Regional Cooperative Marketing Program is a program of the state. 1% of the hotel motel tax out of these four counties, 15% of that comes back to the region to promote itself. So we work with the four county organizations to make sure that we speak to the county very, very well, or to the region very, very well. We use those funds for PR media, international tourism, motor coach sales, and many other different programs. The cultural co-ops is our opportunity to work with arts organizations to advertise and market their events outside of the region. You know, we don't work inside the city of Portland, but we're trying to get that visitor there to come here. And we've worked with all of these groups to enhance their marketing and advertising programs. We also work with many private partnerships like American Express. They're between cash and sponsorship value. That's valued at $140,000. It's a pretty terrific program. We also work with people like Northwest Airlines and the hotels for free airline tickets or free hotel rooms. The Visitors Development Fund is another area where we partner to make sure that we bring in those big conventions. We target who we're going after. We use that money to buy down those conventions, buy down transportation, and find ways to get that convention to Portland. And something we've done very uniquely out of the convention sales department is a three-city alliance with Pittsburgh and Milwaukee. Most conventions move regionally across the country from the East Coast to the Midwest to the West Coast. So we partner with Pittsburgh and Milwaukee to pool our resources at some of the major conventions. So we meet each other's different pieces of business that, if they're in Pittsburgh, could they come to Portland? And it's been a very, very successful program. And just this last month, Fort Worth, Sacramento, and Baltimore decided to copy us. But we're able to do much bigger programs with these with our customers. International sales and marketing. We work closely and get some funding from the Port of Portland, and we work very closely with Travel Oregon on the international sales side of the business. Our job here is to keep those planes full coming this way. Their organizations will keep them full going the other way. So this has been a terrific program, and I know we're working very hard on what the next flight is with Northwest Airlines to Amsterdam. This is the cover of Travel Journal of Japan, which is an educational travel guide. And it's one of the targeted ways we approach business from Japan. And we really go after the school and student groups, and you don't often see the tram with Japanese writing on it. Our other direct service system with Mexicana Lufthansa, which we will work very hard to make sure both of those European flights are good, Northwest Japan, and, of course, we're now beginning to do a little bit of work in China with Travel Oregon with the Northwest feeder flights. Probably the most visible area to Portlanders is the public relations and communications department. This last year, we reached over 170 million viewers, 221 media placements, worth $9.3 million in ad equivalency. The good news about this piece of business is customers believe editorial more than they believe advertising. We couldn't buy this amount of advertising no matter what we did. We have impacts on small businesses with this. And this is a page out of Values Magazine, which is an upscale Japanese lifestyle magazine, where we brought in a journalist and photographer. Magma, which is the company's name of Blake Van Roekel, which is a jewelry designer out of Northwest Portland, was featured in the magazine. And not long after this was published in Japan, she got her largest single order from Bon Marché Japan. So she's very excited about the work that we've done to promote her. The other anecdotal information we have that on weekends, 70% of Voodoo Donut sales are from out of town. That's a pretty amazing number. And they love Deborah Wakefield and our office because we do a really good job of promoting them, and everyone loves Voodoo Donuts. We have an ongoing media outreach, and that the team works with media in New York, Washington, California, and internationally to build desire to visit Portland. And as you may know, the New York Times has been very fond of us lately, so that always helps. The next two slides are from Cooking Light magazine. Deborah and her team worked in New York with the PR firm and spent 2 years talking to Cooking Light, and we were named the number two top city for healthy living in their magazine. And as you can see from these two slides, it shows local businesses and our farmers market.
Who's number one?
Who?
That other city to the north. So we'll continue working there.
Pshaw.
We use the regional marketing funds here also to work with a PR agency out of New York to help us with this kind of PR, and it really is very helpful, and not only for Portland, but for our regional partners. As we focus for 2008, and you'll see another business card here, we're not shy of the rain. These are the areas that we'll focus on. One of the things that we're finding, sustainable and green is part of our DNA, and people get that. What they also want to know, though, is what else is there to do when I come to Portland? Food and wine is an obvious outdoor recreation, but Deborah and her team are taking a stronger focus on design and creative, which is everything from handmade bicycles to clothes, and family travel, which is something that we've not spent as much time on in the past, but we have great opportunities for family fun in Portland, and we want to talk about those in a much stronger way. Books, another business card. We love our books here. We're currently in the 07-08 plan and are in the process of building. We're going to do a two-year plan, 2008-2010, which will be finished by June 30th, and it will be approved by the Board of Directors, and we'll present that to the city then. Minority participation. We've really tried to stay very close with each of the minority chambers and work closely with them to keep us focused. And as you know, we contract with Roy Jay, who's also in the room, at OCVSM to make sure that we speak to that convention business and try and bring it to Portland, be it large, small, any size possible. We also work with these organizations and give scholarships. And these are scholarships for hospitality-focused individuals that are looking for college education and need a little help to do that. So we're always looking for new ways to expand the reach of the hospitality industry. The Community Action Committee. The board made a decision a couple of years ago that they wanted to make sure that they stayed focused on what was good for Portland is good for the visitors industry, and they chose three different areas, transportation, development, redevelopment, and public safety, to make sure that the visitors industry keeps a seat at the table. And one example of that is working with Carolyn Young at TriMet on the Fairless Squares square issue. We need to make sure that we can get those convention goers from the center to downtown up to the Lloyd Center with no fuss, no muss, and they understand that. And how do we handle the rest of those visitors? So we will stay at the table and make sure that the visitors industry is represented in those kinds of conversations. Last but not least, the last business card. We couldn't get away without showing our horses off. So if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. We are a little quirky here in Portland, and we don't want to go away from that.
Amen.
Amen.
Questions? Thank you very much, folks. Excellent presentation. Did we have a sign-up sheet?
We have one person signed up, Robert Neal.
Roy J., I can't imagine you not wanting to say something.
Yeah.
I'm just...
Sometimes, Tom, all I got to do is sit here.
Who is the...
Robert Neal.
Okay. Thank you. There's no council action required.
Oh, there isn't? Oh, then quick comments on my part. Jeff, thanks to you and your great team. Do a fantastic job to the board. Thanks for your service on the board, and for us, it's almost all upside what you do, and you make us look good, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
I'd just like to echo those remarks. Really appreciate the work that Travel Portland does, and I know it's not just Jeff Miller. There's a great staff surrounding him who does really hard work on behalf of our city and our region, so thanks to all of you and to the board. Good work.
Don, one word. I need a headquarter hotel.
That's actually a full sentence. Thank you all very much. To move to the regular agenda, please read item 58.
Tentatively uphold the appeal of Eric Reistad and Hans Bathier, applicant, and overturn the hearings officer's decision to deny a two-lot partition with an open space environmental preservation tract located at unaddressed Council Crest Extended and Southwest Fairmont Boulevard, LU07-113299, LDP, ENM.
Council has before them findings. I need a motion to adopt the findings and uphold the appeal overturning the hearings officer's decision.
So move.
Second.
Please call the vote.
Adams?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Sten?
I'll abstain as I missed the hearing.
Is I here for the hearing?
Potter?
Aye.
We're not keeping track.
Please read item 59.
Approve withdrawal from the City of Portland of property in case number WD-1-07 south of Southwest Garden Home Road and west of Southwest Olison Road.
It's a second reading, call the vote.
Adams.
Aye.
Leonard.
Aye.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Sten.
Aye.
Potter.
Aye. Please read item 16.
Authorize a contract and provide for payment for the Portland building third room floor computer room upgrades.
Second reading, call the vote.
Adams?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Sten?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. Please read item 61.
Authorize a labor agreement with the City of Portland Labor's Local 483 for terms and conditions of employment of representative employees in the seasonal maintenance worker bargaining unit.
Staff?
Anybody?
I thought this was a pretty big accomplishment.
This is a huge accomplishment. I voted against all the other ones.
I saw Richard Beadle out there, but where is he at?
Maybe we come back to it.
Yeah.
Come back to it.
It'd be nice to have somebody testify about this.
Just vote against it.
Yeah. Don't leave Dan to his natural instincts.
Uh-oh. No debate.
Okay, let's go ahead and, I guess she's gone now.
Yeah, they're there all gone.
Okay.
Oh, there he is.
Anybody from OMF here?
Am I the only person here to talk on
this? Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. It's up to you to sell it, Richard.
Okay. Well, I'd like to, first of all, thank the council and the mayor for letting me come forward and talk about this issue. It's very important. It's been a long road. We've worked very hard to resolve a very, very tough issue. It's an issue that a lot of other cities have tried to grapple with and have had problems as well. And it really bodes well to what the intention of the city is toward their workforce to show that they've done the effort they put out to resolve this issue. Of course, I'm here to speak in favor of the city council ratifying this deal. This part-time workforce has provided important services to the public in the maintenance of facilities and infrastructure. They are among the lowest paid workers in the city, and prior to these negotiations, have never been provided health care. When the city does ratify this agreement, it will be the first time a part-time seasonal workforce anywhere in the country, from my knowledge anyway, have been offered this level of health care protection. This landmark deal was only possible because of the close collaboration between Labor's Local 483 and the Portland City Council and Mayor and their mutual understanding that this workforce, because of its low pay status, would not be able to afford health care without help from the city. This took a real effort by the city's benefits department as well as the human resources to put together a deal that was affordable for this workforce. I would like to thank BHR and the Benefits Department for that work and that effort. This is a culmination of a very successful, collaborative, interest-based bargaining process that I feel is an example of what we can hope for in the future. Now, this has been a very, this has been a lot of work by a lot of people to get this workforce to where we have it today. And I'd like to thank the City Council. I'd like to thank the mayor for the support for this very long but successful effort. Oh, there she is.
And I'd like to thank
I was doing this all alone. I was, yeah. I'm going to wing the rest
covering
of
for you, Yvonne.
And I appreciate it.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. As part of the deal, of course, besides the health care piece that I think everybody's familiar with, we also have a COLA attached to this with a 2 to 5% range, which is standard and I think is generous. Also, we've extended the hours from 860 hours to 1,200 hours. This will allow this workforce to be used in a more flexible fashion and also make it healthcare a little bit easier to deliver to this workforce, as well as we increase the safety gear and boot allowance from $50 to $120. Now, it'll be biannually, but it gives them an amount that they can afford to buy a higher quality safety gear when they show up for work. We also decreased the amount of time it took to actually acquire this this reimbursement. Originally, it was 3 months. Because of their low pay status, we had problems with getting the safety gear into these onto the workplace, and so we reduced that to 2 weeks. And so it was a very collaborative effort, and I really appreciate the city's efforts in putting that together.
Thank you, Richard.
Okay.
For coming forth. When we started the negotiations on the S&W successor.
Would you like to identify yourself?
No. For the record, my name is Yvonne Decker, director for the Bureau of Human Resources. When we started these negotiations on this particular successor agreement, we decided to do a more, instead of a traditional form of bargaining, we actually decided, Richard and I agreed, that we would do interest-based bargaining, especially as it related to healthcare. As council knows, and certainly Richard and I know, that was not an easy solution. It took a lot of discussion, really putting up our interests and trying to figure out how do we get there for this particular work group. This is unusual. I think for the city of Portland, we are, as far as I can see, the only employer that right now is providing and will be providing health care coverage for this group of people, for a truly a seasonal group of employees. And so it was very difficult in getting there, not because either side didn't want to get there, but just trying to craft a solution. But we were able to do that. We've set this up where our employees will actually begin registering for health care in May of 08 in order for them to be eligible to receive benefits by July 1. The other issue that Richard and I, through this bargaining process that we're committed to working through, working with for the duration of this four-year agreement, is how do we create a long-term plan for bringing seasonals on into the city workforce on a continuous basis? You know, how do we get them gainful, long-term, permanent employment? And so we are going to be working over the next 4 years on some type of pilot or project in which we can actually get those things accomplished. And I think that's the direction that the city need to go in for this group of people. I think it meets our Bureau's objectives, and it certainly meets the objectives of the union and for this work group. But as Richard has informed council, this is a four-year agreement that does cause for health care, that does cause for CPI increases over each of the 4 years. And some increase increases in clothing allowances. Other than that, all other terms of this agreement is the same as the terms of the agreement that was in place from 2004 to 2007. And so the union has already ratified their portion of the agreement, and we're here for you to ratify on behalf of the city.
Questions from the commissioners? Thank you, folks.
What's the term of this agreement?
The term of this agreement will be July 1 of 07 to June 30th of 2011. So it's a 4-year agreement.
This is the first reading?
No, it's an emergency.
No, it's an emergency.
Okay. The asterisk there by the number.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, folks. Is there a sign-up sheet?
I did not have a sign-up sheet.
Is there anyone here who wishes to testify to this matter? It's an emergency, call a vote.
Adams?
Well, as anyone who's followed my work as a city commissioner knows, I've criticized private businesses for their poor treatment of part-time workers and seasonal workers. And I've also criticized the city in the past, up until this point, for engaging in what I feel were very similar practices with part-time and seasonal employees. I voted against the last time this came up. I voted against it in protest, and really wanted to underscore the seriousness that I put on us addressing this issue. And I want to thank both of you, Yvonne and Richard, for your work on this. I know it was difficult. And you've been creative and stalwart. And Richard, you've been a great partner for us in addressing this issue. You're showing incredible leadership, and Yvonne as well. So I want to thank you. And I'm very happy that we got this done. I'm very happy that we're one of the first in the nation. I hope that other governments will use this, the outcome of this effort, and as you mentioned, Richard, the process, the interest-based process that we used to get here as a model. Thank you. Aye.
Leonard?
When I first entered the Oregon legislature in 1993, the biggest shock I had, and I'll never forget it, was going into my first Democratic caucus meeting in the Senate. So all of the folks that I served with, I had known prior to me being in the Senate, but I had never been behind a closed door where everybody let their hair down. So when the door closed and the people who I thought were great Democratic leaders fighting for working people had things come out of their mouth about labor organizations and working class issues that shocked me. I was shocked beyond words. I could not believe the difference between what people said publicly and actually what they believed when the doors were closed. I have said here in the last 5-plus years since I've been on the council a number of times, and I really mean it, what a pleasure it is to work with 4 other people who believe the things that we're about to vote on publicly and privately. This has been a consistently unified message on the part of the council, as Commissioner Adams alluded to, but each of my colleagues feels just as strongly when the doors are closed about treating employees fairly, even part-time seasonal employees, as they say they do publicly. And I greatly honor that and appreciate that. And it really is important on issues such as health care that we figure out solutions to people who don't have health care. This is one strategy, is to make sure employers at every opportunity provide health care. And it's one of the reasons that I enjoy working here, is being able to do things just like this, to treat people who are in many ways voiceless, in many ways at the bottom of the economic ladder, with dignity and respect. And the people here don't just say that. They do things to make that happen. And I really appreciate your good work, Richard, on this, and Yvonne, your good work in making sure we craft a responsible, balanced solution, and it's really a pleasure to support this. Aye.
Saltzman.
Good work on coming to terms on this, and I'm pleased to support it. Aye.
Stan.
Well, I couldn't be happier about this. I feel like I've talked to both of you for many years about trying to figure this out, and it shouldn't be it's not immediately obvious why it's so hard to figure out how to ensure part-time workers and seasonal workers, but it is really difficult. So I think hopefully we'll have a president who goes after universal health care this next time around. But if we don't have that happen, and there's not a better way, I think we've come up with something, and hopefully we can share this with other employers. The one thing that is absolutely certain, when you push away all of the politics and the difficulties, and I think it's really just been more technical, trying to figure out how to make it work with our pool the last stretch of time, because I know the council's been committed and BHR is committed, and certainly, but you've been exemplary in never letting go of this and serving the people that have put you there. So I think we found a way to get there, and I'm very excited about it. And I hope that, I was going to say, the one thing that is completely certain is that these folks are working full time and they're probably in a lot more danger of hurting themselves than I am, and they deserve health insurance. So I'm very, very glad to vote aye.
Potter.
Thank you both very much. I vote aye.
Thank you.
By the way, Yvonne, Richard did a great job covering for you.
And I appreciate it, too.
Should hire him.
I did. David Schaff.
Yeah.
Please read item 62.
Accept bid of Triad Mechanical, Inc. for the Mox Bottom Pump Station Remodel Project for $687,360.
Morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Mayor Potter, City Council. For the record, I'm Jeff Baer with the Bureau of Purchases, and before you is a request to execute a contract with Triad Mechanical for the Mox Bottom Pump Station project for Bureau of Environmental Services in the amount of $687,360. And as part of their subcontracting plan, they've identified that they are awarding 12.5% of their subcontracting dollars to it's a split between a minority business enterprise and an emerging small business. So they have a fair amount of diversity in regard to subcontract activity. They are in full compliance with the equal benefit requirement, and if I'll address any questions you might have related to the project.
Questions from the commissioners? Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Is there a sign-up sheet on this?
I did not have one.
Is there anyone here who wishes to address this issue? It's a report. I need a motion and a second.
So move.
Second.
Please call the vote.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Sten?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. Please read item 63.
Approve application of the Oaks Parks Association, a nonprofit corporation, for continuation of property tax exemption with exceptions.
Mr. Saltzman?
Thank you, Mayor. This was an item I think that was intended for the consent calendar, but didn't find its way there. Oaks Amusement Park has been providing citizens of Portland with recreational opportunities since 1905 and is now operated by Oaks Park Association, an Oregon nonprofit. Oregon law provides a property tax exemption for properties like Oaks Park that's held by a nonprofit organization for public parks and recreation purposes. This exemption is granted for 10 years and was granted in 1987 and again in 1997, and now it's before us again for another 10-year period. We have staff available if there's any further questions.
You know, we haven't voted on this during my tenure, and I'm just a little curious about how Oaks Park is a nonprofit and how that works. I mean, where's the public benefit here?
First of all, my name is Elaine Nunn, and I'm with Portland Parks and Recreation. It's not the They are a registered nonprofit. Any money that they make, income that they charge from the rides and other things, goes right back into the operation of the organization. If they were ever to dissolve, all that money would, after paying all their bills, would go actually to the city to continue the operation of the park.
Maybe I can help a little bit. I think at one point, I don't remember when, it was obviously a private sector concern, and for a variety of reasons, it was determined that they just could not make a profit anymore. I mean, they were just not going to be able to do the work that needed to be done to upgrade the park, and so a group of concerned folks focused on saving Oaks Park and came up with this kind of organization to preserve it, and otherwise it was threatened with closing. And I, for one, am grateful.
Other questions? Thank you. Is there a sign-up sheet on this?
There was. No one signed up.
Okay. It's a non-emergency and moves to a second.
So I just want to, since we're on the topic, and before it goes to second reading, and I don't know if anybody from the board is here. So when I saw this on the, I'm glad it didn't end up on the consent, actually, because for anybody who grew up in Portland, I mean, Oaks Park is like the center of the universe, and up to and including my own grandson, who loves still going there. But my earliest memories are going to Oaks Park and the skating rink, and my Irvington woodshop teacher taught roller skating to the Oaks Park rink, and I just have great memories of it. The firefighters and police officers hold their picnics there to this day every year. And if there's anything that's Portland, it's probably, honestly, Oaks Park. I mean, it really is the heart of the city, and many young people, you know, love going there, and we go there all the time. So I am a person who's very, as the mayor is, careful about property tax abatements, and because they are expenditures. But I honestly can think of no better use of property tax dollars or expenditures than something as really wonderful as what Oaks Park is. I mean, I can't even imagine what Portland would be like without Oaks Park. It's kind of frightening to think about, but it's a great place, and I'm really happy to be able to support it. So if you see those folks, please pass that along. Thanks.
And other statements? Thank you. It's a non-emergency. It moves to a second reading. Read item 64.
Accept a grant from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation for $18,200 for discovery and scoping for a system to provide the public greater ability to report and track maintenance issue on park property.
Commissioner Salzman.
Again, this should have been on consent. It's accepting a grant from the Sloan Foundation to help us work on tracking maintenance issues.
Is there a sign-up sheet?
Yes, there was. No one signed up.
Okay, it's not emergency and moves to a second reading. Please read item 65.
Call special elections to fill the unexpired term of commissioner position number 2 on May 20, 2008, and if necessary, July 15, 2008.
Good morning, Mayor. Commissioners, my office received a letter from Commissioner Sten.
Could you introduce yourself?
Oh, sorry. Gary Blackmer, Portland City Auditor. My office received a letter from Commissioner Sten notifying us of his departure from City Council effective April 4th, 2008. What that does is that triggers, under the city charter, the call for 2 special elections to fill that seat. And the resolution before you sets the dates for those elections. A nominating election must occur within 90 days of the office becoming vacant, unless council has a reasonable cause for delaying it. Then if a runoff is necessary because a candidate does not get more than 50% of the vote, that has to occur within 45 days of the nominating election. What we looked at in terms of the calendar was that the timing under the charter allows us to have the election on the May 20th primary. We would have to pay for a special election for a runoff if that was necessary. So in looking at the calendar, though, it was very difficult to try to get the follow-up within 45 days for a number of reasons. Number one, the 45th day happens to fall on the 4th of July, and the holiday makes it particularly difficult for voting to occur, you know, in close proximity to that. Number two is that Oregon statutes for mail ballots require that those ballots for out-of-jurisdiction voters are mailed at least 45 days in advance. It seems like a long time, but apparently that's what the military personnel require in order to receive the ballot, vote, and get it back to us in time to be counted. So we were looking at a conflict between Oregon Revised Statutes and the city charter. Statutes require at minimum 45 days of the ballot being mailed out. The charter says at most 45 days till the election. Well, there's going to be the worst case scenario from the standpoint of even fitting within it is if we have three candidates and there's a close race between candidate two and three. It will take the county quite a while beyond the election night to certify the ballot in order to then print the next ballots to go out. So from our standpoint, we felt like the most prudent period of time for the runoff would be July 15th, which is 56 days after the primary election. That gives us a little bit of time in case there's a difficult point between candidates two and three. But it follows the spirit of trying to have that follow-up runoff as soon as possible. We talked with the county, and there is definitely a high cost for having a special election that is not included in the regular dates of elections. And in the case of the special election scheduled for July 15th, that cost would be $362,250, I believe. I got the figure here. That is an estimate because it depends on the turnout. And if for some other reason another local government decided they needed to have a special election, we'd happily share the cost with them. So at this point, that is an estimate. It's in the it may not cost us anything if a candidate is elected with more than 50% of the vote in May.
Sorry, what did you say that cost again was for the runoff?
$362,250.
Why does it depend on turnout?
They process the ballots, and it's my understanding that the formula is based upon the size of the jurisdiction. So that's how it's calculated. So that if, for example, a water district wants to have a special election, it's a smaller number of electors, and so they base it on the number of ballots that are returned, is my understanding of the calculation. So
really? So, I mean, the 362,000 would be less if, say, 100,000 people vote?
Compared with their estimate of what the vote would be, yes. So it is, and that may be a pessimistic estimate because this would be the only thing on the ballot. It might have a lower turnout and we'd have a lower cost. I guess one of the discussions that's happened among council members is the possibility of extending it and having the vote in September, having the primary vote in September and a runoff in November. There are some differences there are some difficulties I think council needs to consider in deciding whether that kind of a delay would be worthwhile. I think number one is the difficulty of operating a council with only four members for an extended period of time. Just to give you an example, the last two special elections, the more recent one, Charlie Hales departed on May 30th, 2002. In that case, the primary was held on September 17th. It was 110 days later. It was outside the 90 days that charter calls for, but the council had what it thought were reasonable causes for delaying it, which is putting it into September. And September, that date is one of the special election dates recognized by Oregon statute. It was a natural point when there are elections that occur on that date. Earl Blumenauer departed May 24, 1996. The primary in that case was also a September 17th. That was 116 days later. So in both those cases, the council chose to, rather than having an election sometime in late July or early August, having it in September within the 90-day window because that September date they felt was more likely to have a higher turnout. And In this case, if we were to hold the election on September 20th, which would be the comparable date under statutes, it would be 169 days from the Commissioner Sten departing until that election. Now, keep in mind, if a runoff were necessary, there would be a longer period of time till that runoff, until the vote was certified, before someone could take office, and that could extend out as far as 233 days with only a four-member council. The best-case scenario under what this May 20th and July 15th would be if someone were voted out right in the primary, they could take office after the vote was certified. That would be 95 days of operating with only a four-member council. So that's one difference I think you'll see between delaying till September and having it earlier. There's a greater likelihood that it would cost more. If we have someone elected outright in May, we don't have to pay for any June election. If we have a vote in September, it's guaranteed we'll have to pay something for that election. And then we may not need a runoff, but that would have been a free one in November. So to a certain degree, there's an additional cost guaranteed if we wait till September. There may be a greater likelihood another government would have something brought up and put on the ballot for the September that could reduce our costs, but that's not a guarantee either.
So the cost would be the same?
I would assume it would be the same.
There's nobody else.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's a state-sanctioned election date
Correct.
In September.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, because it's a state-recognized one, it could be more likely we would have a partner on the ballot, but we can't be assured of that. I guess my sense of the intent of the charter is that under this form of government, the commissioners and the mayor are actually administering bureaus, and the intent was that we can't have bureaus spread, you know, burdened on four council members for too long, that having someone elected quickly and put into those positions is the best approach. But again, that's balanced against, I think, a consideration of providing a good competitive race among candidates. So that's a council decision. One of the other considerations that I've heard talked about is public campaign financing.
Well, could I interrupt you?
Sure.
I'm the one that asked you the question and asked Nick Fish, whom I was talking to about a different issue, the question about a September election as an option. And I haven't talked to any of my colleagues about this until yesterday when the mayor called me to check in on the issue. So it's an issue that I raised with you, just mm-hmm. I wanted to sort of, what are the options? And it was really, so today is the only discussion we're going to have about this as a group. And so I appreciate you preparing sort of your thoughts about the pros and cons about that issue and the other ones you're about to talk to. I mean, for me, there are a couple of issues that as I listen to you and others, I'm going to sort of weigh, and I just wanted to get them out in the open. One is, you know, how do we provide adequate time in a campaign to air out the issues? And some of these are definitely competing. How do we provide adequate access to voter-owned benefits as we look at this special election? How do we try to ensure as consistent of treatment of stakeholders, in this case voters and candidates, and there are others, I'm sure, and then what's practical and doable? And there are probably other considerations, but sort of those are the four, and I look forward to this discussion, but mm-hmm. I know there's been lots of rumors circulating in City Hall around dates, and I know how politically sensitive this is, but that was rolled out as what if.
Right, exactly, and that was my sense. I think it's really important to consider all the options and weigh them. And so to that extent, that's why I did some extra thinking about what are the pros and cons of various things. And you know, I believe council's intent to provide publicly financed campaigns is an important thing, that if there's any way we can accomplish multiple objectives in scheduling a special election, that we should try to do that. But again, you know, we need to fill this position under the charter, which is the overruling kind of a guidance that we have as well as recognizing state law and public campaign finance. The commission has been working on trying to craft the special code that would need to be written for qualifying in a very truncated period. They don't have a solution yet. So it's unfortunate that we don't have it figured out yet, but in some ways this is an opportunity for the commission to study what happens in this race and think about what we can do in the future if they can't include something now.
Isn't the commission meeting on Monday?
The commission is meeting Monday night, and one of the things I've heard from several council members that they would like to hear what the commission's views and recommendations would be if there's any possibility of doing something around public campaign finance for this May 20 date.
Well, just to speak to that subject so that those that are discussing it can take into consideration my viewpoint. I'm only one person here, and admittedly, I'm the only one that didn't vote originally for the public financing a mechanism that we have, but I would hope even those that recognize it and support it would concede that I've been very supportive of it since, including the changes, including defending it against what I consider to be unfair attacks when some people abuse the system. So I just believe in fairness, and fair is fair. And just kind of as an overview, I think it is exceedingly unfair to change the rules for an election during the election. I would be adamantly opposed to, while this process is in play, and this process meaning the filing and the election of somebody to fill the spot, to at all tinker with any of the rules or the processes associated with that election. On the other hand, if we did just as you suggested, looked at how this election which was conducted, which is the first election, special election, since the passage of voter-owned election, and viewed it as an opportunity to see how the system worked, what needed to be done after the election was over, I'd be entirely supportive and probably go along with whatever recommendation came along. But it is bad public policy to do anything that even remotely looks like we are participating in an election as a council politically, one way or the other. And I think that for the sanctity of the election process, I'm glad we're not going to be do anything with the dates today. And also, in my view, it calls into question the fairness of the election if, in response to the election, we adopt some rule for public financing. If it wasn't done up till now, I say wait till after that process is over, and then let's sit down and do it then. But I would not be supportive of any efforts to change any of the rules of this election.
Well, Commissioner Landry, I could just make a comment, and obviously I don't have a stake in who wins this as much as the four of you who will have to work with them. And the two declared candidates for my seat, Nick Fish and Brendan Finn, are people I have high admiration for and have friends with both of them. And I've been obviously both worked with Otter Bachmer and used the public finance system, and I believe it's a better system, and have supported the candidates running. But I do think that I would offer an alternative, which is I think that what you just did, Commissioner, is insert the council into the discussion. There's no rules to be tinkered with. The rules have not been written yet for special elections. That's nobody's fault. It was unanticipated. And I would suggest strongly that what the council should do is be quiet and let the election commission debate the rules. And once they look at the facts, which are very different than I think how you describe them today, adopt what they recommend. I mean, I think that's what the five council members should say, is we appoint an election commission to look at this. They have far less stake in this than you or I or anybody else, and they ought to have a chance to look at it. And if they recommend that there be no, which I think there's a good argument for, I'm not even really getting into the substance, but at this point, after today when this is passed, somebody could in theory qualify for public financing by getting $1,005 contributions by the end of the month. That will be very hard to do, if not close to impossible, if you're not really ramped up and ready to go. The alternative that I think they should consider, and I'm not necessarily ready to endorse because I think it needs some public debate, but I think to say that it's monkeying with the rules is actually slanting it towards a certain result. I think what they should consider is whether or not those candidates who are collecting $5 contributions for Commissioner Adams' seat be given the option to switch to this seat. And the reason I think that's a reasonable thing to look at is, and not to your seat, by the way, I think there's a very strong.
Are the votes there for that?
I think there's a very clear rationale that says before you start collecting $5 contribution, you ought to say who you're running against. Because one might say, I'll give you $5 and support your candidacy for an open seat, but not against Commissioner Leonard. In fact, that would have been my position to the folks I've given $5 to. I would not have given them $5 to run against you, and I did to run for an open seat. That being said, this is an open seat that's been created by my resignation, and nobody had any way of knowing it was coming. And so I think the crowd that has decided to take 6-7 months of their life and go after $1,000 contributions has done that in good faith. And had my friends Nick Fish or Brendan Finn or anybody else opted to run against these publicly financed candidates as private candidates, which they did not, and they could have very easily, and this opportunity came along, nothing would bar them from switching. They can move the pack the second they change their mind and switch seats. And so, in effect, the lack of rules, not rules that are being monkeyed with, the lack of rules basically says that a candidate who's decided to be beholden to the voters rather than to raise big money cannot switch, and one who had decided to raise big money could. And so to me, it's a skewed playing field inadvertently. I can see the argument of not doing anything, and I think that's there, but I would urge the council to say the five of us ought to take the position that we are not going to modify the Election Commission's recommendation and let the Election Commission, who I think is the only thing that we have in terms of a neutral body, pick that, because depending how they interpret the rules will determine the field. And the determination of the field will determine the winner, and so it could be that none of the candidates in the other race want to switch. That's something, you know, there's only a few of them. So if they all decided to announce that they have no interest in switching, and I haven't determined that they do, then you know that would be one matter, and reporters could go and ask them, you know, certainly before Monday to see whether this is a moot point. But that is the one thing I would support. I would actually share, and then I'll be quiet, your analysis if the proposal was. And again, I'm suggesting we support what they do, so they maybe could come with us. But I would say I would hope they would not make a proposal to lower the threshold, to make it less than 1,000. I would hope they would not make a proposal to radically change the dates in relation to the election. The only thing I would consider is whether those folks who have in good faith set out to run for an open seat on the council under publicly financing might have a chance to pick which of the two open seats they go for, as every other candidate can.
But you're suggesting that be left to the commission?
But that be left to the Election Commission to determine. Now, it would have to be ratified this council, and the council, of course, has every right to vote yes or no. I'm just saying I think the only clean thing the council can do, I only make my argument because you made yours, but I think the only clean thing for the council to do is say you can make any argument you want. This ought to be decided by the Election Commission.
Well, to be clear, and I appreciate your perspective, but to be clear, I was talking about whether or not you set up a scheme whereby people go out and collect signatures to qualify.
No.
That's not what I was talking about.
Yeah,
that they
okay.
shouldn't do that. You took it to another level. Yeah. I mean, if you somehow think that by me suggesting they shouldn't come up with a new date for fresh faces to get fresh signatures is somehow interjecting politics into it, and then suggesting somehow that people who were signing up for one seat then all of a sudden are allowed because we changed the rules midstream to sign up for another seat using those same signatures, without telling the people that collected the $5 that that's what they were intending to do, is not injecting politics. I don't know what is. I mean, I absolutely expect you to have the position you do. You feel very strongly about this. The auditor feels very strongly about this. The Citizens Commission are a group of people that feel very strongly about this. All I'm saying to you is, I'm just warning, there are a lot of people who don't feel that strongly about this system in this community. And what it appears like is that those that feel very strongly about it have the ability to write the rules and change the rules whenever they think it furthers that system. And there are those of us who aren't entirely bought off on the theory behind the system. So it feels a little bit like on the fly, because we have a vacancy, we're going to write special rules, or actually not even write them, but change them. So people who have been collecting signatures for one seat can now all of a sudden shift those to another seat. That is just patently, you just don't, in my view, the worst thing that we can do is interject ourselves into an election, whether we think we're doing it for noble purposes or not. It is inappropriate to do that one way or the other. However, having said that, if after this election we wanted to sit down and say, okay, for perspective vacancies that may come up in the future. Should we have a system where people want to take their signatures they've been gathering from one seat and transfer them there? Not only would I be open for it, I'd probably vote for it.
Well,
I'm suggesting is in the middle of this election, for this seat, you do not write rules or change rules. You wait till the election's over and do it, because here's what's going to happen, Eric. I've been promising you this is what's going to happen. The first thing that will happen is if that message goes out, and it just did, by the way, goes out, we're going to start having our calendars fill up with people who are running for office who will have their own view on what we should do that will benefit them in running for this race. And there is no way that's not going to happen. They will have their own argument about what we should or should not do based on their own particular perspective. And what I'm suggesting is if we're writing rules to address all of that, it looks to the greater public like we're somehow putting our finger in the electoral process.